So Shlishi of Vayechi is a short aliyah, but there is a lot there. And there is a lot for us to consider, and we won't have time to consider everything, but we'll try to give at least a little bit of an overview of some of the themes that are in this handful of psukim that appear in this aliyah. And there's quite important messages, so maybe what we'll do is we'll read through the psukim first, just these brief few psukim, and they basically form a unit, and then we'll talk about it all as a unit. So the psukim tell us that Vayar Yosef ki yashis aviv yadimino al rosh Ephraim, v'yeru be'enav, v'yismoch yad aviv v'hasir osa me'al rosh Ephraim arosh Menashe. So Yosef saw that his father had placed his right hand on Ephraim, Ephraim being the younger of the brothers, and this was not something he thought was right. So he tried to hold up his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Menashe's head. Ve'yomer Yosef elav v'lechein avi, ki zavuchar, simi mincha rosho. So Yosef says to his father, you have it wrong, that this is the Bechor. Menashe is the Bechor, so you should put your hand on him. Vayimayin aviv, the father refused. Vayomer yadaiti v'niyadaiti, I know what I'm doing. Gam hu yavam v'gam hu yigdol. Yes, he will be his own nation and he will be great. Ulam achiv hakaton yigdol mimenu. But his younger brother, he will be greater than him. V'zaru yemelo hagayim. And his descendants will be a multitude of nations. Rashi here notes that the contrast, saying that Menashe will be great, Ephraim will be even greater, is that to emphasize specific descendants here, that in the context of Ephraim, Rashi writes, Sha'asid Gidon Lotzeis Mimenu, Sha'kadosh Baruch Osu Neisal Yado, Gidon was no small potatoes, Gidon was definitely substantial, but coming from Ephraim is going to be Yoshua, and Yoshua, Rashi emphasizes, Yanchel Es Ha'aretz V'Lamit Torah L'Yisrael. He is going to bring about the acquisition, the inheritance of the land, and he will teach the Torah to the Jewish people. So it continues, Vayavarchem, Bayom Hahu, Lemor, Becho Yavarch Yisrael, Lemor, Yisimcha, Elokim, Kephraim, Mechumanasha, Vayasim, Esephraim, Mechumanasha. So he goes ahead with it, and he goes ahead with this way, and he says, this is what's going to be the model for the brachos of children from here on in, as we know is the case, and we'll talk about that a little bit, that they should be blessed to be like Ephraim Menashe. V'yom Yisrael Yosef v'nenuchi meis v'hoyo lukim imochem v'heshiv eschem el eretz avoseichem. So then Yisrael says to Yosef, here I am dying, and God should be with you, and he will return you to the land. V'ani nasati l'cho ashchem achad alachecha asher lakachti miyad ha'amori b'charbi v'kashti. So here I will give you this extra Shechem, this extra portion. It's a little bit of a mysterious pasuk. We'll come to discuss this more over your brothers, that I took from the Amori Becharbi Bekashti, which literally means my sword and my bow. But we see that Chazal and the Gemara and Baba Basra actually have many additional thoughts about this. So let's now look at all these psukim together. So, first of all, the pasuk tells us that Yosef saw this. So when did he see this? Because we're in the middle of the bracha process right now. The bracha's already started in the previous aliyah. So some of the Rishonim understand that it's a little bit out of order here and that this happened before the brachos, even though we're in the middle, and that Yosef would have said so then, because otherwise what's the point in having him switch his hands afterwards? Others say, no, this indeed was happening at this later point. And Yosef didn't mention it earlier because he thought what Yaakov was trying to do was to divide up the privileges here and to kind of give a little bit of extra treatment to each one. So that maybe, okay, he's going to put his right hand on Ephraim, but maybe he'll say more about Menashe, and therefore it'll equal out. But then he sees that they're basically getting the same brachos, so he becomes more concerned. Soloveitchik understood that his concern is at this point, because until now it was more general brachos. Here, this, now he's getting more specific, and therefore he becomes more concerned about the process. There's also a medrash where you have Yaakov responding to Yosef, the pasuk describing that Yosef's trying to lift up his hand, and Yaakov says, "Don't try that. That was already tried with me by the Malach, and I prevailed." So what's going on? This is an arm wrestling match. This is supposed to be a rematch, wrestling again now, just with arms. So Rishvi Dushinsky understood that maybe the dialogue here is that Yosef is saying to Yaakov that maybe Ephraim is the bigger Talmud Chacham, but Menashe is the one who has the political savvy, and he's the one who's going to be able to be a stronger leader in the Golus. And Yaakov said, "I already had that fight. That was already the whole issue between me and Esav, and I already prevailed and established that even the Lamdisha guy, he can be the one who is able to be the leader in the Golus, and trust me, I know what I'm doing." Mefarshim also ask that instead of asking Yaakov to move his hands, to switch his hands back, so Yosef could have switched their seats, that also would have changed the situation, would have brought things back in line with the way he wanted to. So the Ramban writes over here that he didn't want to embarrass the Bechor, getting him to move out of his place. That would be an embarrassment to him. And that's interesting, because it seems like either way this is kind of an awkward situation. And that's a point that was discussed by Ram Rivlin, who was the Mashkiach for many years in Karen Biavna, the Sefer on the Parsha, where he notes that this is just a kind of a life lesson here, that we have a major goal not to embarrass people, and we do whatever we can to avoid embarrassing people, and we shouldn't think that it's all or nothing, that if I have to take a step that's going to involve some embarrassment, so then it's no longer a concern, but rather whatever you can do to minimize the embarrassment. So here, okay, if this is going to be the conflict here, so then better he should ask his father to move his hands rather than take the Bechor and actually have him move his seat. The Netziv has a different understanding here. The Netziv says it was important that they stay where they are, because at least this way, so Menashe didn't have the right hand of Yaakov, but he was by his right foot. And that has its own significance, especially because the foot represents Halicha, and that was his strength being able to move in the world and to show leadership in that way. And he was getting a little bit of a taste of that bracha, per se, of that emphasis, and that was important not to move that around. And this is a major issue, a major point that we shouldn't miss here, because this is a very different dynamic than Yaakov and Esau, or at least in some major ways it's very different than Yaakov and Esau, because it's not that Esav is losing out to Yaakov, and so too Menashe is losing out to Ephraim. What's crucial for us to appreciate here is that they're both getting the bracha, and the template that is going to be passed on to the generations is Yisimcha Kefraim U'Menashe, that we join the two, that this is a joint bracha. It's just there's a certain emphasis here that is being transferred from Menashe to Ephraim, and there is whatever reason there is for that, but it shouldn't be the implication that Menashe is getting knocked out here. Menashe is a major part of this bracha process, and we'll say a little bit more about that. It's just that the hands are creating a different point of emphasis, but they are very much jointly receiving this bracha. So therefore, the significance of Menashe being by Yaakov's right foot is not something to downplay, is not something that's meaningless, because their joint participation in this bracha is a major part of what's happening here. And the idea that there is still a difference between the two of them, and that Ephraim represents something in a more powerful way than Menashe, so that there's a lot to figure out, and Rashi emphasizes that it has to do with their future descendants even more than it has to do with them. And that it's about Yehoshua versus Gidon, and Gidon being a great man, but Yehoshua representing a certain specific model for the Jewish people, that is really the focus here. And this is a topic that the Rosh Yeshiva of Karen Biavna, a minute ago I mentioned the Mashgiach of Karen Biavna, that the Reshiv, Kamri Avna, Rav Goldvich, has a lot to say about this. Chaim Yaakov Goldvich in the Sefer Sufas Marachos, he has, on this short Aliyah, he has three long essays. Very extensive. You could do a lot of reading over Shabbos if you have the Sefer Sufas Marachos. If you don't have, I would highly recommend it. So in the Sefer, on Parshas Vayechi, he has three long essays on this short Aliyah. And he talks a lot about this specific quality of Yehoshua, that Yehoshua was the one who was going to bring them into the land. Right? That's what Rashi also emphasizes here, Hu Yanchil Asaretz, and the whole notion of the Eretz Yisrael mentality, in contrast to the Midbar mentality, which is a major theme in the Leforshim and the Bali Machshava. And it's a topic comes up a lot in the context of the Meraglim, where Yeshua, of course, played a major role as well. But the whole transition from the Eretz Yisrael totally spiritual existence, where everything was, sort of Midbar rather, Midbar totally spiritual existence, where everything was given to them, to the transition into Eretz Yisrael, where they had to be active participants in making a life, and making a spiritual life that was literally grounded, that was expressed through the land and expressed through the day-to-day labor. So that's what Yehoshua represents, and that's what is being emphasized here in the bracha, and that's a big part of the message that Yaakov is trying to convey. It's also fascinating that there is a medrash which Rav Svengel quotes, and it's brought into the discussion. We've talked about it in various contexts, the whole difference between rabbinic law and Torah law, and the whole question of whether there is a fundamental difference in how rabbinic laws are expressed and what they represent. And there is a dispute about this. So the view that dinim d'rabbanan are not inherent, but are rather what we call a mitzvah legavra. They are an instruction to the individuals to follow the dictates of the rabbis, but they don't represent inherent values or inherent significance in the dinim themselves. So that's a view that many achronim have. But Rav Svengel disagreed, and Rav Svengel pointed to a medrash, which is actually in the context of Chanukah, so it's a little bit of synergy, we're a few weeks off, but in the context of Chanukah, it makes the point that one shouldn't say that I don't have to listen to the rabbis, I only have to listen to God, because God says, I endorse what the rabbis say. I sign off on what they enact. And that's a major aspect of Chanukah, all kinds of reasons for that. But in focusing on this medrash, Rav Svengel is making the point that it's not just that we have to listen to the rabbinic rules, but that the rules do take on an inherent character because the Kaddish Baruch Hu endorses them after the fact. So what's very fascinating is that medrash has a certain point of emphasis within Hilchos Chanukah to make that point, but then it also points to this pasuk. It says, how do we know this? Because Yaakov switched his hands, and because Yaakov emphasized Ephraim. And so the Rosh Yeshiva has a few essays about this, but in one of them he focuses, they're both about really Yehoshua being the point of emphasis here, coming out of Ephraim, but in one of them he emphasizes Yehoshua's anivus, right? That Chazal tell us that he was the Talmud who was not necessarily represented through his ability to remember every Achron that the Rebbe was telling, but that being the one who set up the benches and the one who was there to serve the Tzibor, and the notion of Anivus, which is brought up in the context of Moshe Rabbeinu also in order to emphasize how he is a Navi of unique distinction and that Miriam and Aaron shouldn't be questioning him in the end of Parshas Baloscha. So that notion of Anivus, of being completely given over to the mission of transmitting the Torah, so much so that their identification with the Torah becomes complete, and therefore what the rabbis say is so purely in the service of the values of the Torah, even when they seem to overturn the Torah, even the idea of Yishkoach Laker Dover Menat Torah, even when they tell you not to blow the shofar on Shabbos or take a lulav on Shabbos, and the Torah had said otherwise, but even that HaKadosh Baruch Hu signs off on. All of that is because of this midah of Yehoshua and Moshe being able to be mevatel themselves completely to the message. And maybe that's on one level what the Medrash means when it says that you can look to this pasuk and see where the whole endorsement comes from. And in the next essay, he takes a different angle, and he says, similar to what we were noting a few minutes ago, that the role of Yehoshua as the one leading the people into Eretz Yisrael, and there requires an active partnership, not just a passive recipient of the grace of God as they were in the Midbar, but they had to be active participants in creating the world in Eretz Yisrael. So that represents the Torah Sheval Peh and the pilpul of the Torah Sheval Peh, the effort and the work, and Kadosh Baruch Hu endorses that partnership and that which the Chazal come to enact and to innovate, he endorses and becomes not only obligatory, but something that has inherent value to it. Okay, so all of that could be included here. But there's also a point that a number of the Sfarim raise, that it's a little surprising that Yaakov would do this, because you would think that maybe he learned his lesson, right? That didn't his favoring one child over the other, especially bypassing older children, so didn't that have disastrous consequences that took up all of these past few parshios? And in fact, the Gemara says in Shabbos on Daf Yud that we should learn not to favor one child over the other, because look at what happened with Yaakov and the coat that he bought, and look at everything that emerged from that. So it's a little surprising that here he would seemingly enter into the same territory and favor one child over the other, especially when it's the younger child right in front of the older one. So there's an essay about this in the Sefer Mishkan Bezalel of Rabbi Bezalel Radinsky, where he notes the comment of the Chidah that there was an agreement between Ephraim and Manasseh along the lines of a Yisachar Zvulun kind of agreement. I think he writes, the Chidah writes, they were the first to have this, which is a little hard to understand because presumably Yisachar and Zvulun were the first. But okay, they continued the tradition of having a Yisachar Zvulun agreement. And the Mila of that, in addition to other things, is that it's a way of emphasizing that you can be a partner with someone else and that everyone has their distinct role and that they're all valuable, each doing what they do. So the idea that Ephraim and Manasseh had that kind of relationship, that they were able to partner up and to emphasize each other's strengths and to allow them to flourish together, shows there's no kinna between them, there's no jealousy there, and therefore he was confident that this was appropriate. The Sefer Das Shlomo, he has a similar point, which takes a little further. He says that Yaakov was essentially establishing that fact. He was testing them. He wanted to see what Ephraim's and Manasseh, what their reaction would be, and to see that Ephraim wasn't lording it over Manasseh, and that Manasseh wasn't expressing kinna. So he saw that they had that kind of a partnership, and that was what he was looking for. And to reemphasize again, that was the theme of the brachos, that the brothers are going to be the joint template for all brachos, so it's not about one or the other, it's about understanding how they're able to work together as a unit, and that's a major part of really the whole parsha. We say regarding the brachos to the Shvatim, the pasuk says, Ish ki brachoso birachosom, that Yaakov blessed all the Shvatim, each one with their own text, each one with their own message that was tailored to their own talents and abilities and issues. Each kibirchoso, but berachosam, so it's plural. So it's fasemis understood that the message is that he was blessing all of them together, that each part, each shevet within Klal Yisrael should be able to contribute its unique aspects and talents and kochos to the Klal. So yes, there's a bracha going to each one as an individual, but that bracha is then serving the klal. So, ish ki brachaso, berachosam, and that's also what's being conveyed here now to Ephraim and Manasseh, the ability to come together as a unit and to recognize how they're dependent on each other is what he was looking for. And maybe that's what he was seeing, that indeed they reacted properly, and that was the goal. It's interesting because we also have a limud from this parsha that there is a notion, won't get into the details now, but there's a notion of mutar l'shanos b'fnei ha-shalom, that one prioritizes shalom over other things, even over the strict truth. It's a derivation from this week's parsha. So we find in other areas of halacha also that shalom is given priority over many other things. And some connect that to a medrash. The medrash comments on the pasuk in Tehillim, Bakei shalom v'adfehu. So we should chase after shalom. We should look for it, and we should chase after it. So the medrash says that you see that shalom is even more powerful than mitzvos, because when it comes to mitzvos, we're told to do them when we have them in front of us, but we're not told that we have to chase after them. We don't have to do a redifus ha-mitzvos. Some bring that up, actually, the whole discussion of the Shemitah year and whether there's an Indian to Davka acquire land in Israel so that you will be able to observe Shemitah in that sense, which is a topic we're not going to get into right now. But just one detail of that is that it brings up the question of, if you're not currently subject to a certain mitzvah, is there a notion of seeking after it, of being rodef after the mitzvah? So here the Medrash says that we don't find the language redifa by mitzvos, we find it by shalom as opposed to mitzvos. So there's a sefer called Zivchei Shlomo, where he comments that the reason you have this distinction is because when it comes to mitzvos, so we already know that there's no one person who's going to be able to perform all the mitzvos of the Torah. It just doesn't work that way. So no one person does all 613 mitzvos. However, you're still connected to all the 613 mitzvos because you're a part of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, the zchusim of all of Klal Yisrael are relevant to every member of Klal Yisrael. But for that to be true, there still has to be unity among the people. They have to be considered together with each other. So shalom, that's crucial. That we can't live without. Any specific mitzvah, that we can let others handle if we are able to have a sense of connection to them. But we need shalom in order for that to happen. So that's one of the themes that we find here. Okay, so he goes on to say that this way that I am blessing these boys, this will be the template for how children will be blessed in the future. B'chai Baruch Yisrael. So there is a discussion, first of all, what does that mean? We see that is the practice. We use this nowadays. Targum Yonasan suggests that this is a reference specifically to Yom HaMilah. Not immediate clear why that should be. And Rebbe Kamenetsky in his Sefer on Chumash, he suggests that you see the whole progression here is that the bracha is given to the children, in this case the grandchildren, as also a bracha for the parents, for the middle generation, that they should be able to raise their children in such a way. So the moment where that's highlighted is the moment of the Mila, when you're bringing a child into the bris. So perhaps that's the message. But in any event, we take this text and we bless our children with this. And many have a custom to do this specifically Friday night. So it's interesting why that is. We find it associated with Erev Yom Kippur also. But why Friday night specifically? There's nothing here that would seem to indicate Friday night more than anything else. So in the Sefer Mavri Abok, he understands that it's because that's the day that there's no kitrug from the Sutton. So there's no counterforce that's coming to undermine the bracha, so it's a good opportunity. Similarly, in a similarly supernatural vein, Rabbi Yaakov Emden notes that it's the day of Shefa Brachos. It's a day when there's just an abundance of blessing in the world, and it's a good opportunity to try to convey that to your children. It's interesting because it's those who take a more practical stance, the Chassam Sofer and Achuva, he writes that it's simply that during the week we're all busy and we're running around, and you don't have so much time for this, but on Friday night hopefully we have a little bit more Yishuv Hadas. It's interesting that there are those who don't say the Harachamans on Shabbos, the practice of the Vilna Gaon and others, because they involve Bakashos. So that may not necessarily be as appropriate for a Shabbos. while others davka do. Especially, that would seem to be why the Harachamon for Shabbos exists, the assumption that others certainly at least say them. But others davka only say them on Shabbos for the simple practical reason that during the week they're running around and they have to jump back to work as soon as they finish benching, the Iker benching. But on Shabbos, they have more time, so they're able to express things a little more fully. And that's where the Harachamans then get their due. You find other representations of that in the Tefillah of Shabbos as well. The idea just that there's a little bit more ability to take a breath and to focus, and that should express itself. The Likutei Ma'arich extends this idea. It's not just that we don't have so much time during the week, but also there's a lot of tension. People are running around and they're fighting, and Shabbos is a more peaceful atmosphere, so we're able to kind of allow that to atone for the tensions of the week and to set a tone for the future week, and it's a very appropriate setting for that. Okay, so the last pasuk of this aliyah is very mysterious. This idea that Yaakov says, I've given you this extra Shechem. It's the place where Yosef was kidnapped. And he's saying that I'm giving you this city for your Nachla to be buried in. Now, whether it's a reference to the city specifically or just to an extra portion, that's a part of the mystery here. But we don't seem to remember Charbi Vekashti. When was there a war over this? Where was the sword and the bow and arrow? When were they invoked? So that's also a part of the mystery here. So the Gemara in Ar Masechta, but we're a little far away, the Gemara in Bava Basra and Daf Kufchav Gimel, understands, Rashi quotes it here, B'charbi v'kashdi hi chachmasi u'sfilasi. So here it's talking about wisdom in tefillah. Unklus has it a little bit different, slosi u'busi, which are both ways of saying tefillah, that doesn't really have a literal reference to a sword and to a bow, but rather it refers to tefillah or tefillah and chachma. So why do we assume that it's not literal? The Torah Tmimah talks about this. The Gemara already notes, Gemara Bavas already notes that there seems to be a stira to this from Pasuk in Tehillim. But also the Torah Tmimah points out that it's out of order, because in a physical war, so the arrows come first because they work from farther away, and then come the swords when you get closer. So that seems to also be a little bit of a clue that it should be interpreted differently. Hi?
Well, there also seems to be a stira with like five psukim from now, which is, you know, here he seems to portray Shechem, the capture of Shechem, as some sort of like, if not positive, like, you know, some sort of like achievement, and then
you mean regarding Shimon and Levi?
Yeah, and regarding Shimon and Levi, he's very critical. So, like,
it doesn't sound like that's what he's talking about. You know, so he said, yeah, "I did this," and he never endorsed what Shimon and Levi did. So he didn't even do that through Shlichus. So he's just talking about something else. So it seems like it's not literal, and that's the tradition that Chazal have. But also the idea of it being tefillah, and two types of tefillah. So the Meshech Chachma comments that the two types here is that the cherub, the sword, so that refers to established tefillah, the parts of the tefillah that are there, kavua in the siddur, and the arrow represents the private bakashos for salvation, kind of somewhat similar point distinguishing between private and public tefillos in this context. But this notion that the sword is the general tefillah, and the arrow is the more private or tefillos that one will add, is a fascinating one. Rabbi Eliezer Geltzeller, Zichrono Lebrach, was an extended relative, my part of my extended family. So in his Sichos, he notes that what you see here is that the difference is also conveying that an arrow can go much farther than a sword can. An arrow can get from a distance, but it's all going to depend on how much you put into it, how much force you put into sending the arrow. And that is a part of the different potential of the tefillos that we have. So the standard text, so that takes you to a certain point. But the arrow, if you invest more in it than the personal aspect of tefillah, so that can get you much further. It's all a question of getting the balance between those two and having that typify your tefillah experience. The Rosh Yeshiva Rav Goldwicht had an essay about this as well. As we mentioned, these three long essays on this one short aliyah. And he talks there about an additional perspective in the Medrash, which he combines with this, that the Medrash quotes Rabbi Yehuda as saying that the Shechem here is not the city, but this is really a reference to the Bechorah and to the garments of Adam HaRishon that Esav had, that he acquired the Bechorah and this garment from Esav. And what does it mean, Becharbi Bekashti? It means mitzvos and meisim tovim. And the Rosh Yeshiva had a very long essay about this. I'm not doing it justice just by conveying one aspect of it. But he suggests there that, similar to what we're saying here, about the notion of the difference between a sword and an arrow, and one being able to accomplish its mission only up close, like the sword, and the arrow being able to go much further. But there is also a difference in that a sword is, it's an ironic phrase, I would say the blunt instrument. It's a sharp instrument, but it's blunt in that it doesn't necessarily require that much skill. If you're up close with somebody and you have a sword, so you're able to do a lot of damage. An arrow can get much farther, but you need much more skill. You need much more training to get an arrow anywhere near where it's supposed to be. So the effectiveness of the arrow is much more dependent on the focus and the skill and the training of the user than the sword is. And he says that's also what's represented with mitzvos and meisim tovim. So what's the difference between mitzvos and meisim tovim? So mitzvos are just clear religious obligations. And meisim tovim refer to those actions which are righteous, but they are defined more by intent than by circumstances. That because a person is doing something for a certain reason, and within a certain context, that's what makes it holy and of a spiritually significant nature. So each one has its own aspect to it, but the idea of the influence that the user has in being able to create that experience is more significant in the arrow muscle, and that's what Meisim Tovim is meant to convey, and that's also a part of the whole Bechora component that Yaakov eventually proved himself to be the expert at, to not only fulfill the overt requirements of the mitzvos, but also to be able to create Meisim Tovim, to bring through perspective and through intent and through the recognition of various circumstances what was the Ratzon Hashem and what was the right thing in every context. And that's what he's trying to convey to his grandchildren now, and to his children and to his grandchildren, that this is a part of the complex mission of life, that there is the mitzvos, represent the sword, more represent the established text of tefillah, the basic requirements that we can point to and that are unambiguous. And then there is also the arrow, which is the more powerful, but also more individualized and more complex accomplishments in this world that requires one to be much more focused, to be much more spiritually sensitive, more accomplished. But through that, great things can happen. And this is a part of the goal of combining the kochos of Ephraim and Manasseh and the message of Yehoshua who would come from Ephraim. And this is the major emphasis that Yaakov wants to convey to his descendants. So that should be their mission, and that should be our mission. But as we see, it's conveyed also in the format of tefillah. So that should be a good segue for us to daven.